Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Tonight, we are going to have Dr. Dan Kripke speaking on how sleeping pills can harm us. Dr. Kripke graduated from Harvard University, attended medical school at Columbia University, and did his residency at Albert Einstein. He has spent the last 37 years doing research here at UCSD. In 1973, Dr. Kripke established one of the first sleep clinics in the United States. And in 1981, he published the first controlled clinical trial of bright light treatment. For the past 20 years, Dr. Kripke has been doing research on light treatment and treating patients with light. He has written hundreds of medical articles and has given lectures in over 18 countries. We're very honored to have him here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jody. Thank you all for coming. Let me just say that a long time ago, I worked with the American Cancer Society. I'll tell you about it later. And I was hoping that sleeping pills would help people as a young doctor. But what I learned then was very disturbing. And then I worked with one of the drug companies. We were trying to prove for the chronic insomnia patient who takes a sleeping pill every night that the pill helped them. We studied performance very thoroughly. We could not demonstrate any benefit, only risks. So, yeah, I've spent most of my time with light treatment because that helps people. But I keep being asked to talk about sleeping pills because I don't have any financial interest, pro or con, for them. And so I've been studying the issues of harm and good, and I have some new information for you tonight. This slide's a couple of years old. It shows that 2 years ago, Americans filled at least 43 million prescriptions for sleeping pills. It's probably quite a bit more now because of the heavy advertising. And I want you to notice that Ambien, we now have the generic version called Zolpidem, and Sonata, which is Zaloplan, and Lunesta, which is Esopiclone. Those three pills, which we call benzodiazepine agonists, had three-quarters of the market 2 years ago. They probably still do. So those are the pills I'll mainly be talking about. And the first question about sleeping pills is, what are the benefits? What good can they do you? We have some quite new information from a new meta-analysis. Now, a meta-analysis is a combination of all the studies which are available. And this was done by people working for the NIH with no financial interest. And surprisingly, they questioned whether by EEG, by objective data, sleeping pills help people sleep more. Let me show you that. The top line here shows that objectively, these benzodiazepine agonists only help people sleep 11 minutes more than with placebo. And it was not statistically significant. It's true they help people get to sleep 13 minutes earlier, but then they did not significantly decrease waking after sleep onset as compared to placebo. That's very little benefit. Now, subjectively, what people thought happened, they thought they had more benefit for sleep, more benefit for sleep latency, more benefit for mid-sleep waking than the brainwave said they had. And why is that? This is a consistent finding that people think sleeping pills are helping them more than our recordings show. And I think it's because these pills suppress memory. Really what they do is they help insomniacs to forget how poorly they sleep. The new meta-analysis found that sleeping pills have a significantly higher risk of harm than the placebo. That means these Z drugs cause more adverse medical symptoms than the placebo. Didn't decrease medical symptoms, increased them. And there was also strong evidence for publication bias, which means that the unpublished results were quite likely worse than the results that have been published and advertised. You know, half of sleeping pill prescriptions go to people over 60. So here's another meta-analysis published in the prestigious British Medical Journal about people over 60. And they found that 13 people had to take a sleeping pill for one of them to have improved sleep quality. But if six people took a pill, one of them was going to be harmed. So they concluded that there was more harm than benefit with sleeping pills for people over 60. Same sort of conclusion. So what are the benefits of sleeping pills? Very little. Very little. What are the risks? That's mostly what I'm going to talk about today. First, I wanted to talk briefly about performance. That means how well you do things the day after you take a sleeping pill. Most people are concerned their insomnia will interfere with how they act the next day. They're hoping the sleeping pill will give them more energy, will make their minds more alert, and so forth. But actually, most studies which objectively measure performance show that sleeping pills make performance worse, not better. Sleeping pill users tend to report they're doing better. They think they're benefiting when actually the pills are making them perform worse. And even their own relatives see them as worse with the pill than without. Insomniacs are worried about their driving, maybe with good reason, but taking a sleeping pill will not help you with your driving. There's no evidence for that. In fact, most of the studies show that sleeping pill users have more accidents than people who don't take sleeping pills, and that includes zolpidem. What affects performance that way? To understand that, you have to understand what happens to the blood level of the drugs and what we call the half-life, which means how long it takes for half of the drug to be gone from your blood. In the blue curve, you see short-acting sleeping pills like zolpidem. The gray areas represent each a night's sleep, and the white areas each the following day. So with the short-acting drugs, the sleeping pill is mostly gone by morning, and it has very little effect the next day. In fact, it has very little effect in the second half of the night. With the purple drugs, drugs like temazepam or lorazepam, they're about half gone by the time you wake up, pretty much all gone by the following night. So they do have some benefit in the second half of the night. On the other hand, the drug is there in your blood turning off your brain cells during the day as well as at night. And if you look at the red curve, which represents longer-acting pills, pills like diazepam and flurazepam, these are mostly still in the blood 24 hours later. So if you take another pill the next day, the concentration gets higher and higher and higher over a period of days. And these pills accumulate to very high levels day and night. And maybe they're making people sleepy, but they're also turning off people's brains during the day. To go into a little more detail about the Z pills, this dark line represents zaleplon. It has the shortest half-life. So it's mostly gone if during your time in bed. It's mostly gone in the first half of the night. And in fact, in the second half of the night, because you might be in zaleplon withdrawal, you might actually sleep worse. And the same is true of zolpidem, and the same is true to some extent with esopiclone. The red and the blue represent zolpidem and the extended release form. They last a little longer in blood. There's often still some the next morning, but not very much. So these drugs can produce early awakening, but they also can produce some hangover after you get up. And the green represents esopiclone, which does have a longer half-life. It stays in the blood longer, particularly with elderly people. And for that reason, it's more likely to cause hangover. It's more likely to impair performance in the morning than the other Z drugs. I chose this quote just to emphasize that the manufacturers have to admit that when you're taking one of these drugs for a while and then you stop it, the next night your insomnia is likely to be worse than if you had been taking placebo. There is some withdrawal effect, even for the short-acting drugs. These are, after all, the benzodiazepine agonists and the benzodiazepines are physically addicting drugs. They produce dependency. They produce withdrawal effects. And there are three kinds of withdrawal. For these short-acting drugs, there can be withdrawal at the end of the night causing early awakening. There's going to be withdrawal the next night after you stop. I see a lot of patients who take sleeping pills and they say, whenever I stopped, I had an awful night, so I went back on the drug. They don't realize if they'd stayed off the drug for a few nights, their sleep would get better. And then with long-term use, particularly of high doses, people can become quite habituated and can have more prolonged withdrawal syndromes. To review, most evidence shows that all hypnotics result in daytime impairment, or at least not improved function. The impairment is worse with the very long-acting drugs, and the risks of having these drugs in your brain during the day, essentially turning off your brain cells, is more automobile accidents, more falls, more memory loss, and more confusion. Sleeping pills can cause temporary dementia. They are the most common cause of reversible dementia. Particularly elderly people taking the long-acting sleeping pills that develop these very high levels can really become very confused, really lose their memories, and look like they have Alzheimer's disease. It builds up sometimes over weeks. It sometimes takes weeks to go away after you stop the pill. That's a very disturbing symptom that you sometimes see in your elderly friends and relatives. The hypnotics can cause bizarre behavior. Maybe you've heard about some of these. They're funny, peculiar, sometimes not so funny. People have night eating. They go to the refrigerator and take strange things to eat or eat strange quantities of stuff, like a whole jar of peanut butter, for example. And then maybe you heard of the Ambien zombies. Representative Patrick Kennedy was an Ambien zombie. He got in his car. He drove somewhere. He got in trouble with the cops. He had no idea what he was doing or why he did it. We do sometimes see cases of that. I used to think these things were real rare. Now I realize maybe 1% of people who take Zolpidem and maybe the others of these drugs has some very bizarre problem, either night eating or the ambient zombie problem or hallucinations. The FDA has warned that all of the sleeping pills can cause sudden severe allergic reactions. I want to take a moment to talk about Remeltian because it's different from the benzodiazepine agonists. It is a different kind of pill. It doesn't involve itself with the benzodiazepine receptor. It's a melatonin agonist. But even so, it has very little benefit. Objectively, it shortens the time to fall asleep from 7 to 16 minutes, but usually doesn't increase the total sleep much during the night. In fact, it might be objectively weaker in its benefits than the other pills. Certainly people think it's weaker. People don't seem to like Remeltian as much. You know why? Because it doesn't cause much amnesia. So I think people remember that they don't benefit very much. But it does have less risk than the benzodiazepine agonists. It doesn't cause dependency. It doesn't cause the same damage to performance and memory and so forth. Not as many falls. No evidence of effect on driving. In those ways, it is safer. It does have some peculiar effects on endocrinology, on prolactin and testosterone. Nobody knows much about how important those may be. So much for Remeltian. I come back to this not to pick on esopiclone, but it's an interesting manufacturer's statement. It says, adverse events that suggest a dose-response relationship in adults include viral infection, dry mouth, dizziness, hallucinations, infection, rash, and unpleasant taste, with the relationship clearest for unpleasant taste. Relationship, that means this drug causes an unpleasant taste in 34% of patients who take it. Notice that they've mentioned infection twice. This is real interesting. The manufacturer tells everybody that this drug can cause infections, but I've never read or heard of another doctor talking about these hypnotic drugs causing infection. I don't know why it is, but let me show you some of the data. This is an interesting risk that I and my colleagues are just beginning to study. This was maybe the most important study with esopiclone, a big study, almost 800 participants. And in purple, you see the different kinds of infection and how many occurred with placebo and how many occurred with esopiclone. And when you add it up, this is a long-term study, 6 months. 22% of the people who took placebo developed some sort of infection, but 37% of the people who took esopiclone developed some sort of infection, 70% more infection. And after all, this is a randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trial done by the manufacturer to try and show their drug was good. And the fact is it caused a lot of infections, hundreds of infections. But I think it's all the benzodiazepine agonists, not just esopiclone. Here's some data from a very recent paper about Zolpidem, the extended release form. Well, there were more people randomized to zolpidem than placebo because they wanted to study more people on drug than placebo, but it is a random assignment. Well, 22 cases of sinusitis of those given zolpidem, only 3 given placebo. That's over 3 times the rate of sinusitis in people who took zolpidem. Why? I couldn't tell you why, but this is the company's evidence. It's a little more murky with Zaleplon. This is the manufacturer's summary of their own data. In 28-day studies, the percentages that developed infection, fever, sinusitis, herpes, urinary tract infections with Zaleplon compared with the percentage that developed it with placebo. Well, it's something like 80% a higher rate with Zaleplon. Again, it appears that this benzodiazepine agonist, even though very short-acting, must have been causing infection. When we come to this new drug, Remeltian, the data are a little unclear. There is some reason to suspect that Remeltian causes infection, but I'm not sure. Maybe it doesn't. I don't really know if it's safer in this regard or not. So this is some new evidence about an adverse effect. Now let's talk for a moment about depression. About half of patients who have insomnia seem to have some depression. When you work in a sleep clinic, as I do, about half the people who come complaining of insomnia, we think they're really depressed. And what's more, even among those insomnia patients who don't look depressed when you see them, they're at higher risk of developing depression than are people without insomnia. Now, there's a lot of scientific argument about whether insomnia causes depression or it really doesn't. And that's not resolved, and it's not really what you want to know. What you want to know is, if you have insomnia, you're worried about getting depressed, will taking a sleeping pill prevent depression? Well, here are the data which we compiled from almost 8,000 subjects who were described in the FDA new drug applications for these drugs, which are now available on the web. If you really looked hard, you could find these data on the web. And what it showed is that 2% of the participants in these controlled clinical trials randomized to the hypnotic drug developed depression during the study, and less than 1% of those given placebo. So there was 2.2 times the risk of developing depression for the participants assigned to the hypnotic drug. That means that hypnotics cause depression. They don't prevent depression, they cause depression, something that isn't very commonly discussed. Incidentally, Remeltian causes depression also. For further information, I wanted to mention, I have a website. It's called thedarksideofsleepingpills.com. And I have a cartoon in which I dress sleeping pills up as the Grim Reaper. That's to help you remember a point which isn't really so funny. Let me explain it. In 1958, just 50 years ago, the American Cancer Society started the Cancer Prevention Study 1. This was the first big study that showed cigarettes cause cancer and heart disease. And then, 25 years later, they did the cancer prevention study too, to look at filter cigarettes, which they found also cause cancer and heart disease. Now, the American Cancer Society was nice enough to work with me and let me examine these data, because they had asked about whether people took sleeping pills, whether they had insomnia, how much they slept. Incidentally, in these data, insomnia was not associated with increased mortality. In fact, it looked like people with insomnia lived a little longer. Isn't that good news? But the cancer prevention study 1 showed that hypnotics were associated with increased mortality. Now, when we had that result, probably most of these people were taking barbiturates that nobody really takes anymore. So we didn't think too much of that. And we did a much better study in the cancer prevention study 2, when people taking sleeping pills were mostly taking benzodiazepines. And we found that hypnotics were associated with increased mortality. Let's look at those data for a moment. Look at the bottom line. These are people who said they took a sleeping pill 30 times a month, which means every night. And remember, most prescriptions go to people who are taking pills every night. Why? Because one person who takes the pill every night uses more prescriptions than a whole handful of people who take them only occasionally. Well, among men, there was... First, let me say that the people who said they took sleeping pills had about twice the mortality. But when we controlled for all kinds of what we call comorbidities, other diseases, smoking, exercise, heart disease, diabetes, so forth, which might help explain that, then after controlling for everything we could, the men still had 25% higher mortality if they took sleeping pills every night, and the women 24%. And both in men and women separately, this was highly significant. Now look above at the people who took sleeping pills from 1 to 29 times a month, but the middle person said they only took sleeping pill about 3 times a month. So this is very occasional use, they were reporting. But the men had 15% higher mortality and the women 10% higher mortality. So even occasional use of sleeping pills was associated with higher mortality. Well, you know, when the Cancer Society studies came out, the tobacco company said, oh, maybe smoking cigarettes is associated with cancer and heart disease. That doesn't mean it causes it. They don't get away with saying that anymore. The sleeping pill companies still get away with saying the fact that use of sleeping pills is associated with higher mortality doesn't prove that they cause that mortality. And there is some truth in that. But I want you to know there are now 15 epidemiologic studies that found higher mortality among people taking sleeping pills. Studies from Japan, studies from Europe, studies from the U.S., done by many different investigators in different ways. There aren't any studies suggesting sleeping pills save lives. And this includes Zolpidem, the most popular drug today, as far as the latest study is concerned. What did people die of taking sleeping pills? Well, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and cancer. People who took sleeping pills have a higher rate of death from cancer. So what about sleeping pills and cancer? It turns out that if you really studied page by page about 2,000 pages of stuff on the FDA website, which I did. You found something very surprising. This involved more than 8,000 participants in controlled clinical trials done by the drug companies with the intention of proving their drugs were great. There were 8 skin cancers in the participants randomized to the sleeping pills, and this is Zaloplan, Zolpidem, Azopiclone, and Remeltian combined. There were no skin cancers in the groups given placebo. There were 4 other tumors in the sleeping pill group, none in the placebo group. Now, when I looked at the data for those 4 other tumors, you couldn't really be sure whether they were cancers or they weren't. But I asked the FDA to go over their clinical records with the benefit of more time and so forth. And if I understand what they wrote me, they did determine that those were cancers and that this is no overestimate. So 12 cancers and tumors in the sleeping pill group, none in the placebo group. Looks like sleeping pills cause cancer. And mind you, we're not talking about association, we're talking about randomized controlled clinical trials, which should demonstrate causality. It's the first data with causality about cancers. You find something more if you read all that fine print that might surprise a lot of people. All 4 of these drugs, Zaloplan, Zolpidem, Azopiclone, and Remeltian, cause cancer in animals. The drug companies know that. They reported it. They don't advertise it. So I think there are some problems of interpretation with these studies. We need a lot more research. All of these studies aren't nearly large enough to be absolutely sure. But I think as a group, these hypnotic drugs, probably cause cancer in humans. Not sure, but I suspect so. I want to be careful to point out that there's not enough information about any of the individual drugs to say that this drug or that drug causes cancer. The data are about the whole group. So we really could use a lot more information. If you're taking a drug, you'd probably like to know if it causes cancer, and we really don't know for sure. So friends, here's my warning. Sleeping pills could be hazardous to your health or cause death from cancer, heart disease, or other illnesses. And the way I read the data about benefits and risks, sleeping pills do more harm than good. That's my conclusion. Well, thank you, but there will be time for questions, but I'm not quite through yet because you'd like to know what the alternatives are.
Yes.
Let's first mention that chronic insomnia, most insomnia is chronic. It lasts for years. We actually don't know much about its clinical course and natural history. And it's pretty hard to distinguish primary insomnia by itself, from sleep trouble caused by some other illness, you know, arthritis, heart disease, whatever. A couple years ago, the NIH had a conference on chronic insomnia. You can find it on the web. They reviewed all the literature, and they concluded that what's called cognitive behavioral treatment was better for chronic insomnia than long-term use of any of the pills. So that was the official consensus conclusion. The cognitive behavioral treatment is better than pills. To go over that a little more, cognitive behavioral therapy has the best demonstrated long-term benefits and the least side effects. Most of the sleeping pills actually aren't recommended for more than 1 month's use. And the sedative antidepressants, which actually are prescribed very commonly by doctors for sleep, really haven't been studied very much. We don't know much about their benefits and risks. So what's the cognitive behavioral treatment of insomnia? First, the cognitive treatment, which is essentially explains to you why you shouldn't worry about insomnia. Next, what we call sleep hygiene. Next, relaxation therapies, learning ways to relax. You know, a lot of us have had a golf coach and a tennis coach, and we've had a lot of lessons in how to tense our muscles and never had a lesson in how to relax. So that's good. And finally, sleep restriction treatment, limiting time in bed, that I'm going to explain. So here's the cognitive part, the things you need to know. First, you ought to know that the healthiest people sleep 6.5 to 7.5 hours. It actually looks safer to sleep 5 or 6 hours than to sleep 8 or 10 hours. The average adult in the U.S. only sleeps 6.5 hours. You shouldn't think everybody's sleeping 8 hours. No, they're not. It's normal for older people to awaken all the time at night. I tell my patients there are two kinds of older people. People who wake up all the time at night and don't complain about it, and people who wake up all the time at night and do complain about it, but they all wake up at night. People with insomnia, as I mentioned, live longer than people without insomnia. That might help you not worry. And it's harmful to spend a longer time in bed than you can actually sleep. Here's some of the evidence. This is data from that cancer prevention study. These are the number of people reporting 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours sleep. 7 really means 6.5 to 7.5. Notice that the mortality hazard is lowest with 6.5 to 7.5. It's really very little higher with 6 and 5 and 4 hours sleep. It's actually mortality hazard is higher with reported 8 hours sleep, much less 9 and 10, than it is with 6 and 5 and 4. So you shouldn't be afraid if you're a little bit of a short sleeper. You should thank the Lord if you sleep 6.5 hours. That's average, and it looks healthy. This isn't just one study. There are now about 10 studies show the same thing. The Nurses' Health Study, studies in Europe, studies in Japan. It's for sure. What is good sleep hygiene? This is a murky concept, but we have some ideas. A consistent bedtime and especially a consistent wake time helps. Don't spend extra time in bed to make up for poor sleep. Does more harm than good. If you're having sleep trouble, don't take long daytime naps. Shorter naps might be okay. Don't go to bed when you're not sleepy, even during your sleep time. You have to look out for caffeine from mid-afternoon on. Caffeine stays in the blood a long time, and it does keep you awake. Keeps you awake during the day, which can be useful. Keeps you awake at night, which you might not like. Limit alcohol in the evening. Why? Alcohol has a short half-life. So if you have wine or a nice stiff drink with dinner, by bedtime you'll be in alcohol withdrawal and sleep worse. If you drink alcohol at bedtime, it might help you fall asleep, but it'll increase your awakenings later in the night. And we think it's a good idea to get outdoors at least an hour a day or even use artificial light. People weren't made to be indoors all day. We were made to be outdoors. We pay a price when we don't get enough light. That's sleep hygiene. Learn a way of relaxing. There are lots of ways. There are lots of teachers. We don't really know that one's better than another. There are lots of different kinds of meditation that are taught. What's called mindfulness meditation is real popular this year. There are controlled studies that show it works. Prayer works. Seems to be a good idea. Learning to quiet your thoughts, to practice shutting off your mind, that helps. And learning to relax your muscles and slow down your breathing, that helps. All these kinds of relaxation seem to help. Choose the ones you like, practice them. Just like tennis and golf, practice makes perfect. You have to keep practicing. Now, another part of relaxing is avoiding alerting in bed. If you're one of these people who goes to bed and starts worrying, don't do it. You need to worry, sit up in a chair and worry. When you're tired of worrying, then go to bed. You don't want to associate worrying with being in bed. Some people say it relaxes them to read or watch TV in bed. And if you're not having any trouble with sleep, I can't argue with it. But if you are, maybe reading horrible mystery thrillers or watching Alfred Hitchcock late at night is not the best way to make you sleepy. That it alerts you in bed, gives just the wrong habit. And where it's possible, if you're going to do something alerting, don't even do it in the bedroom. Do it in another part of the house, if you can. Sleep restriction is hard to understand and hard to believe. But if you have insomnia, it's really important to reduce your time in bed. It has a lasting benefit for insomnia. It's a very powerful treatment to spend less time in bed. The longer time you spend in bed, the longer it's going to take you to fall asleep and the more you're going to awake during the night. If you spend more time in bed than you can sleep, then you're going to have trouble falling asleep. You're going to wake up more. And you're going to get into bad habits. And it's surprising how important the habits are. So if you think you only can sleep 6 hours a night, don't spend more than 6 hours in bed. And so forth. What you're doing is you're correcting negative conditioning. You're relearning the old habit that you go to bed, you go to sleep. And relearning that habit is a very powerful treatment. It helps more than sleeping pills do. And of course, it's also safe and absolutely free. So that's a very good treatment. These four elements of cognitive behavioral treatment, if you can learn them, they're really very helpful. Okay, thank you. Now it's time for questions. The question is about use of sleeping pills occasionally for travel. There is some evidence that they really do help with sleep with travel. There's even a little evidence that they help with next day performance in the travel situation. But they also do have the side effects of memory problems and confusion and so forth. So whether it's worth it, I'm not sure. But the argument for taking sleeping pills with travel, especially the short-acting sleeping pills, it's a better argument. The question is, what's the story about bright light? Well, we know now that human beings were made to be outdoors. You know, the Garden of Eden wasn't an indoor place. No TV in the Garden of Eden. And the evidence is that I can tell you in a random study of people in San Diego, people who were outdoors more slept better. Now, and we know that the more light people get, the less depressed they are. And as you know, there are now lots and lots of controlled studies that show that bright light is a powerful antidepressant. I mentioned that half of insomniacs have some depression. There isn't much controlled study specifically of the use of light for insomnia, but there is at least one controlled study that showed it helped. So light is safe if you don't get a sunburn. It's free, and it seems like a good idea to get outdoors more. If you're not getting outdoors, that might help your sleep a bunch. The question is about the habit-forming effect of these drugs. How much can you take them? And the answer is you don't get hooked much with one pill in one night. But you might begin to be getting a habit after 3, 4, 5 nights. And after weeks or months, then we see people who are habituated. Over at the clinic, we see patients who say, I've been taking sleeping pills for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years every night, because whenever I stop for one night, I have a horrible night. And they've never tried stopping for 4 or 5 nights and found out that their sleep might be okay if they got over the withdrawal. So that habituation and physical dependence takes a fair amount of time to develop. Nobody can say exactly how long. And I do want to mention that people who are very dependent, particularly on high doses, who are taking more than a minimum dose, it may be dangerous to stop the drug immediately. You may want to reduce it by one minimum dose a week. It has to be done gradually, because for people who are taking high doses, it is actually risky to stop too fast. The first question was about over-the-counter pills. We really don't know as much as we should about what's on the market today. The general impression is that the over-counter pills don't do even as much as the sleeping pills. And some of the antihistamines have anticholinergic side effects that the benzodiazepine agonists don't, drugs like diphenhydramine. And so most sleep experts think that they're not generally a good idea. But there is one advantage of the over-the-counter drugs, which is they generally are not as habit-forming or as addicting. So I wish I knew more about them, but I really don't. And your second question? Where do you get cognitive behavior therapy? There are a number of sleep clinics in town, and I would guess a number of them offer cognitive behavioral therapy. We do at Scripps Clinic. I think they do here at the San Diego VA that's affiliated with UCSD. And there are a number of practitioners in town who do it. We don't have a good list of who does, but there are a lot of people. Let me mention to you, nothing I've told you about that I do, my website is not for profit. There is a for-profit website that isn't expensive. It's called cbtforinsomnia.com, cbtforinsomnia.com. Doesn't cost very much, and it seems to be very effective at teaching cognitive behavior therapy. So far as we know, that website might be as good as a therapist, and it sure will cost you less than coming to my clinic.
Thank you.
There is some debate in the literature about whether valerian has much benefit. There certainly is some evidence that valerian has some benefit, and it's probably pretty safe, though not completely safe. So of the over-the-counter stuff, valerian is probably better than most of it, but I would say most experts aren't very convinced about it. The first question was, does cognitive treatment of depression help with sleep? The answer is probably yes. And there's early evidence, vice versa, that cognitive treatment of insomnia may help with depression. We don't have enough information about that. There's a little bit of information that the cognitive treatment is good for both. Now, another good question was, suppose you do have a medical illness, maybe cancer, which is causing the insomnia. What do you do? Well, we don't have a lot of information, but the information we have is that the cognitive behavioral therapy is useful for people with cancer fatigue, and with other medical problems. Dr. Ancoli Israel over at the VA has been studying that. The early results look good. I don't think you can take useful over-the-counter GABA. Melatonin has very weak effects. Its effects are rather like Remeltian, that it helps you fall asleep a little, not a lot. It's not much good for keeping you asleep. It's a relatively weak treatment, but probably rather safe. And melatonin's never been studied in large studies the way that the prescription drugs have been, because FDA doesn't insist upon it. But the best evidence we have, I would say, is that melatonin works about the same as Rosarum, as Remeltian, and is possibly safer. Yes, sleep doctors are in agreement that if you go to bed and realize you're not sleepy, get up and get out of bed and don't go back to bed till you're sleepy, because you don't want to be in the habit of lying in bed awake. And if you get less sleep that night, then maybe you'll be sleepier the next night. Maybe you're spending too long a time in bed. If you spend less time in bed, you will be more sleepy. You will fall asleep more rapidly. That's how it works. If you wake up and you realize that you're not likely to fall back asleep, get up and get out of bed. Now, if a half hour or an hour later you feel sleepy and it's still within your regular bedtime, then you can go back to sleep. But it is better to get less sleep. Remember, less sleep appears very safe, and the less you sleep one night, the better you'll sleep the next night. Nothing to be afraid of. So if you're not sleepy, get out of bed. That's the usual recommendation. And don't go back to bed till you think you're going to fall asleep. The lady says you should cover your clock at night, and it's not a bad idea. Definitely some experts do recommend it. Certainly you shouldn't lie there staring at the clock. If you find yourself doing that, it's time to get out of bed. The data we have about ibuprofen, aspirin, and other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories is that they really have very little effect on sleep unless you're in pain. If you're in pain, then it might help. Not a good sleeping pill. Ibuprofen is good for many things, but sleep is not necessarily one of them. Secanol and other barbiturates are never recommended and rarely used. And the reason is, first of all, they're more dangerous. They cause more deaths than overdose. Benzodiazepines have many faults, but you have to take 100 or 200 or 300 of them to kill yourself if you haven't been drinking. And few people ever die from an overdose of a benzodiazepine alone. On the other hand, the barbiturates used to produce a lot of overdose deaths. Secondly, they're probably more addicting. More addiction, more withdrawal, more change in the sleep stages, and they do more to your drug metabolism. So it's generally agreed that they're not a good idea.
Are they still prescribed?
You know, there are some old doctors who got in the habit 50 years ago and still prescribe them, but you won't see it taught anymore.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Jody.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.